Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the LSE public event organised by the Centre for Civil Society this evening. And I'm delighted to be able to have with us this evening Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International, who is going to talk to us about the human rights movement and civil society, the final frontier for human rights. Before I ask her to speak, I just want to say a few words about her work in Amnesty and her work before she joined Amnesty in 2001. As some of you may know, Rini Khan is the first woman and the first Asian and the first Muslim to head one of the world's largest human rights organisations. And she has taken on this task at a very particularly difficult time with the challenging events in the wake of September the 11th in 2001. And that's been a period since where there's been a real backlash against human rights. And after taking up a position at Amnesty International, she's done a lot to work on the process of internal reform in the organisation to enable it to respond flexibly and rapidly to world events. And I think there are two particularly interesting innovations that she has introduced. One is to broaden the work of Amnesty in the areas of economic, social, and cultural rights. And the second is to give a really strong focus on the issue of women's human rights and violence against women. And a few words about Irene Khan's work before joining Amnesty International. She worked for 21 years for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in many different parts of the world, and was senior legal advisor for Asia and a senior executive officer to the High Commissioner. In 1977, she helped to found Concern Universal, a UK-based development NGO, and I'm sure we're all delighted to hear that Irene Khan was awarded the Pilkington Women of the Year Award in 2002, just after taking her position up at Amnesty. So I'm very pleased to invite Irene Khan to discuss this issue of the human rights movement and civil society, particularly in these very challenging days we're experiencing at the moment.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me back to LSE. I was actually here in December 2003 in this very room, so it's nice to come back again. Some familiar faces, but I hope you... Some familiar faces, but I hope you won't find my message the same one. I would like to talk today about the challenges that we face as a member of the human rights movement, as an international human rights organization. And I would like to begin with my own experience in September, last September, when I visited Darfur in Western Sudan. And there I went to a camp called Camp Riyadh, just outside El Janina, which was really, it looked like an urban slum, and one of the worst kinds of slums possible, with blue plastic sheeting and sticks just providing shelter to the people, garbage lying everywhere, donkeys roaming about, children playing in the dirt. And there I sat on the sand with a group of women and listened to their stories of displacement. There was a woman called Zainab who told me about how her village had been attacked on the ground by armed men and then bombed, and so many men had been killed that there were no men left to bury the dead. And she and another woman who was also present there in that little group had together buried seven men. And then they were so tired that they could dig no more, so they put the bodies under a shelter. And that same night, the Janjaweed came and they burnt that shelter and the bodies there. And she kept repeating two words in Arabic. And the interpreter said to me that those words were thirst and hunger, because that's all she could think about as they walked for 60 days to make their way into that camp. And she had lost everyone. She'd lost her family. She'd lost all her possessions. All she had with her in that camp were her grandchildren. And she was too scared to return home. She was even too scared to go out of the camp. Now, these women that I spoke to in Darfur, they were simple rural people. They did not understand human rights. They had never heard of the human rights movement. They had no expectations of me as a human rights activist. They were just happy to be able to tell their story to someone, even to a stranger who didn't speak the language. But as I listened to Zainab, I was burdened by my own sense of guilt. I was angered by my own impotence. Earlier that week, we had been traveling in Western Darfur. I had seen sites where African villages had been burned to the ground. They were just red sort of marks in the ground where the huts had stood. Now grass was sprouting up. Camel was grazing there in these abandoned villages. There were a few broken pots here and there. I remember seeing a child's shoe lying in the debris, a reminder of the panic in which people fled. Now, in that kind of a situation, what could Amnesty International do? Name and shame the government? Well, we have been vociferous in our denunciation of the Sudanese government. We have been vigorous in our demands to the government since early 2003, long before the story of Darfur actually hit the headlines. And yet, the killings have continued with impunity and audacity. And in fact, following our mission, Amnesty International has been barred once again from entering Sudan. We could lobby the international community. Well, actually, just after my visit to Khartoum, I was in New York. I met with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. I pressed on him the urgency of deploying the African Union monitors and UN human rights monitors. He fully agreed with me, but we both knew that the effectiveness and impact of the monitors would be questionable in the absence of political will on the part of the government. From New York, I went to Washington, D.C. to testify before the Human Rights Committee of the U.S. Congress. The U.S. congressmen and women listened to me very respectfully and attentively. For them, the answer is simple. They see it as genocide. But they couldn't tell me what action should follow that labeling. When I asked them whether they believed that if this was genocide, then shouldn't the UN Security Council refer the case of Darfur to the International Criminal Court, they were silent. They couldn't answer me because they know the US administration's blind opposition to the International Criminal Court. And to me, sitting there in that committee room in the US Congress, it seemed to me the term genocide was about as meaningless as the term human rights seemed to Zainab. Darfur has exposed the limits of the international human rights movement. As surely as the 9/11 attacks and the war on terror have revealed its vulnerability. In each case, human rights advocates have done much to expose hypocrisy, selectivity, double standards. But the real question remains, why have we failed to correct the situation? What more can we do? How can we galvanize world public opinion, mobilize mass support, which can move governments to action? And those questions become even more critical at this moment as Iraq prepares for elections in the midst of bloodshed, tomorrow as the new US administration is sworn in, second Bush term, as human rights crisis in Indonesia and Sri Lanka are submerged by the recent tsunami disaster, and as the march of globalization brings more challenges in the arena of human rights. What can the human rights movement do? Ironically, human rights have never been more prominent in political and social discourse. What began in 1948 as a endeavor of states have actually become an initiative of people. And over the past six decades, we've seen a proliferation of human rights groups at the local, national, regional, even of course at the international levels, from small community groups to large international human rights organizations like Amnesty, which has some 1.8 million members in over 100 countries. And using investigative research, techniques of naming and shaming, the power of astute lobbying, media work, we have challenged the absolute power of the sovereign state. We have insisted that governments be accountable not only to their people, but also open to international scrutiny. And thanks to the lobbying of many of these human rights groups, we have seen some changes too. There is now a plethora of treaties and laws that outlaw torture, that abolish death penalty, that recognize the equality of women, the rights of children. Thanks to the work of the human rights movement, various human rights groups, treaty monitoring bodies are now in place. There is a High Commissioner, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. There is an International Criminal Court. And at the domestic level, too, there has been progress. We have seen the disbanding of apartheid in South Africa, the development of democratic governments in Latin America and Eastern Europe. We've seen even the tide of impunity turning in parts of the world. And in a whole range of countries, from Brazil to Bulgaria, governments have adopted laws on human rights, have set up national human rights institutions, have introduced human rights education as part of the educational curriculum. So, and for better and for worse, we've also seen the discourse of human rights being adopted by other movements. The women's movements, development organizations, now speak about rights-based approach to development. Indigenous people, landless peasants, disabled, are all plotting their own place in this landscape of human rights. And yet, despite these successes, there remains a very wide gap between rhetoric and reality, as Zainab's case shows. The promise of human rights is still a promise unfulfilled, and I would even say that it's possibly a promise betrayed. Human rights embody common values of human decency and dignity, of equality and justice, and as such, they are the basis of our common security. But in the name of security, human rights are being attacked and eroded today. Human rights are based on universal standards and legally binding treaties, but these instruments are being flouted with impunity. In the post 9/11 scenario, we've seen many governments adopt laws that go to the heart of such fundamental principles as fair trial and the right not to be arbitrarily detained. We've seen legitimate dissent being labeled as a sedition. We've seen repression against opponents and minorities in the name of counterterrorism. And even the absolute prohibition of torture is no longer absolute, as the photos from Abu Ghraib have shown, as the memos written by the Pentagon have shown, that even the term torture is being redefined. And even today, in the newspaper headlines, we've read about the court-martial of British soldiers in Iraq for torture and ill-treatment. And what we also see, of course, is the blatant disregard of the US administration of international human rights and humanitarian law in Guantanamo, in military commissions that are being set up there, in the detentions and renditions, and this is the return of people to territory where they're likely to be tortured. And a creation of a gray zone outside the rule of law, a kind of international zone of extraterritorial illegality. And these practices of the US administration are significant, not only in terms of the human rights abuses that they create, but because they have unleashed a new culture of abuse and impunity, which is infectious. We see, for instance, now the UK government arguing that human rights treaties to which the UK is a party do not apply to UK officials abroad, exactly the same argument that the US government has used for its own officials. Now, it's interesting that President Bush said that this, and I'm quoting him, this new paradigm requires new thinking. But actually what we are seeing is not so much new, but some very old practices used by autocratic regimes, a denial of habeas corpus, detention without trial, ill treatment, unfair trial, torture, these are very well known. In fact, Amnesty's first report on torture was published in 1973. And in that report, and here I'm reading from that report, Amnesty said, "Torture thrives on security and impunity. Torture rears its head when the legal barriers against it are barred. Torture feeds on discrimination and fear. Torture gains ground when official condemnation of it is less than absolute." The pictures from Abu Ghraib show that what was true 30 years ago is still true today. Amnesty wrote in 1973, "Those who consciously justify torture rely essentially on the philosophic argument of a lesser evil for a greater good. They reinforce this with an appeal to the doctrine of necessity." End of quote. In January 2004, you will remember that the US authorities cited military necessity to refuse access to ICRC, to the 8 detainees in Abu Ghraib. 30 years ago, Amnesty wrote, "History shows that torture is never limited to just once. As soon as its use is permitted once, as for example, in one of the extreme circumstances, like a bomb, it is logical to use it on people who might plant bombs, or on people who might think of planting bombs, or on people who defend the kind of people who might think of planting bombs." So what we see here is not very new. But what is, however, new, and a new challenge for the human rights movement, is the way in which this age-old debate about security and human rights has been translated into the language of war. And this is interesting, because by using the language of war, human rights are being sidelined, because, as we know, human rights do not apply in times of war. But at the same time, by using the notion of terror, international humanitarian law, which would apply in times of war, is also being sidelined. And so what is being created is a gray zone where there is no law, there is no rule of law. Thankfully, both the US Supreme Court and the House of Lords have rejected this argument of a lawless regime. And many human rights NGOs, including Amnesty International, were instrumental in submitting amicus briefs to these courts. But despite these decisions, the trend is actually bucking human rights in almost every country in the world, from Australia to Zimbabwe, in an infectious downward spiral. And the collateral damage is quite high. We only have to look at Darfur. The US administration had no credibility with its African or Arab counterparts when it sought to press for action there. In fact, when we from the Amnesty delegation intervened in our dialogue with the Sudanese government, we were frequently interrupted saying, "Well, what are you doing in Guantanamo? Don't tell us how we should treat our people when the US locks people up in Guantanamo or kills people in Iraq with impunity." Now, so what the human rights movement, I think, is confronting here is a crisis in the faith of the value of human rights. And this crisis of values is being accompanied, I would say, by a crisis of governance in the systems that are supposed to uphold and protect human rights. Human rights are to be protected, as we know, and promoted by the international community of states through the United Nations. But that system seems unable to hold states to account. We see the disregard of the Geneva Conventions in Guantanamo, Iraq, or Afghanistan. The UN Human Rights Commission, which is the main UN organ mandated to protect and promote human rights, has never discussed the situation of Guantanamo Bay. It did not propose even a resolution on Iraq last year. It couldn't even agree on a chairperson's statement on Sudan last year. It barely touched Chechnya. Now, the UN Security Council, of course, increasingly mentions human rights in its country resolutions, whether it is Haiti, Sudan, or Democratic Republic of Congo. But the Council is very vague on the action that it can take on such cases. And, of course, the Council is totally paralyzed when it comes to violations committed by its own permanent members. More broadly, if we look at the system of human rights, we will see that while there has been this plethora of treaties and agreements and bodies to oversee them, the ratification of a treaty does not necessarily lead to implementation and much less to any impact. Let's take the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination of Women, which is one of the most widely ratified conventions, 177 states. But it is also the convention with the most reservations. And all this, when the UN statistics itself shows that one in three women in the world faces serious violence at least once in her lifetime. And this gap between ratification, implementation, and impact is true of many other UN conventions as well. And this crisis of governance, I think, is complicated by the weakening of state sovereignty. Sovereignty is shifting upwards to international organizations like the World Trade Organization or to supranational entities like the European Union. It is seeping sometimes sideways, informally, to corporate actors and international financial institutions. It's moving insidiously downwards sometimes to armed groups and terrorists. And in many countries, governance is being undermined also by corruption, by mismanagement, by abuse of power, by political violence. And democracy has led to deep disappointment in many parts of the world, and in some places to what Transparency International described as elected kleptocracy. So it is apparent that democracy by itself cannot promote human rights unless it is accompanied by the rule of law, an independent judiciary, and an active, engaged civil society. And of course, the power of the state is also being affected by the emergence of financial economic actors, by corporate actors, international financial institutions. International trade agreements and international financial institutions are dictating terms and conditions of economic policies. Large multinational companies can choose to invest or divest in a particular country. And for these actors, there is no proper understanding or accountability of human rights. And into this kind of vacuum or weakness that is being created on state sovereignty, we see in certain situations traditional authorities stepping in, non-state actors coming in, whether they are clan leaders in Somalia, the Muqtada Sadr type characters in Iraq, warlords in Afghanistan, creating a state within a state. And in some cases, religious powers are riding on the back of a fundamentalist wave. And to them, human rights pose a threat. Human rights activists pose a threat because we promote global values rather than parochial interests. And among the most affected in this situation actually happen to be women and women's human rights. So against this context, what we actually see is a growing gap between the perceived influence of human rights activists and our actual impact on human lives. And this, in turn, I think, is leading to a skepticism about human rights at two ends of the spectrum, among the poor as well as among the privileged. Neither of them see the relevance of human rights in their own lives for very different reasons. Public passivity to the war on terror is the single most powerful indictment of the failure of the human rights movement today, in my view. It is amazing that organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International that have drawn our support for decades from Western public opinion have failed to actually mobilize public outrage against what is happening to the human rights system. And so I think we need to ask ourselves, where have we gone wrong and how do we put it right? And that question is not an easy one to answer, even as I put it to you, and maybe you may have some ideas that we in Amnesty are struggling to find. And as we in Amnesty International work to make ourselves more externally focused, more impact-oriented, I'm acutely aware that our credibility as a human rights advocate depends on our ability to effect change. And today, I think there are 5 or 6 issues that will actually determine whether the human rights movement will indeed be the final frontier or not. And I think first is whether we are actually able to resist the erosion of human rights. The second, I would say, is whether we can fight for economic and social rights. The third, whether we can build effective systems of accountability. Fourth, develop new approaches for new actors and new issues. And fifth, to engage in new alliances. And finally, last but not the least, whether we can open ourselves to greater accountability and impact assessment. So an agenda, actors, approaches, alliances, and accountability. These, I think, are the areas around which we need, as a human rights movement, to review our own work. And the first, coming back to the first question, can we resist the erosion of human rights in the name of security, the erosion that is taking place today? I think it's very ironic that those who seek to restrict human rights the most today speak most loudly about freedom and democracy. It is unfortunate that the values debate has actually been captured by the other side. And our challenge in the human rights movement is, how do we recapture the language of human rights? How do we reframe the debate on human rights, not simply in terms of law and rights, which is very elitist, which is very remote from most people's thinking, but in terms of what is right and what is wrong. In other terms, as a moral argument based on the fundamental values of humanity and justice. Human rights is about values. It's not only about laws and systems. It's about voice, not only text. It's about the lived experience. It's about galvanizing public imagination and energy. It's about putting morals over law. And here I want to go back to Amnesty International and our goal of abolishing death penalty. When Amnesty began its work on the abolition of the death penalty, international law and national law accepted that. We were not bound by law. We picked it up as a moral issue because we believed that it was wrong for the state to take the right to life. And in the end, I think one must approach values over systems. In the end, the absolute prohibition and torture and cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment rests on moral grounds. Torture is not wrong just because it violates the Convention Against Torture. It's wrong because, rather like terrorism, it destroys the perpetrator as well as the victim, and it debases humanity. It's really the ultimate corruption of humanity. And that's the argument that we need to make, not in terms of the violation of any particular treaty. And yet, I think we need to shift away, because in a sense, human rights has been captured too much by lawyers, and I say it as a lawyer myself. It needs to go back to some more simple, basic language that people can understand, people can stand up for and fight for. And talking about fighting, I think, brings me to my second point about economic and social rights. We can't expect to speak legitimately about morality and justice without speaking about social justice as much as legal justice. And the challenge for human rights activists must be to confront the battle against poverty and growing inequity. More than 1 billion people out of a global population of 6 billion live on less than a dollar a day. More than 3,000 African children, I'm told, die of malaria every day, three times the number of people killed as a result of armed conflict. And over half the population of Africa do not have life-saving drugs. Only 50,000 of the 26 million people infected with HIV/AIDS actually have access to healthcare and medicines they need. Now, although the Universal Declaration of Human Rights actually integrates both civil and political rights and economic and social rights, during the Cold War, there was a different, because of the ideological differences, the two sets of human rights developed differently, with the socialist bloc promoting economic, social, and cultural rights, and, as you know, the Western bloc promoting civil and political rights. Now, the human rights movement here was also partisan, in that, rooted in the West, they opted for civil and political rights, and Amnesty was one of the culprits, I have to say, that worked for 40 years on civil and political rights and ignored economic and social rights. And it was only in 2001 that the Amnesty membership decided to expand its work on economic and social rights. And today, of course, there are many human rights groups that are working in this area, that are looking at issues of discrimination, that are contributing to elaboration of these rights, that are testing these rights through courts, that are working to promote greater accountability. But despite this work, economic and social rights continue to be contested and restricted for a number of reasons. First, by many neoliberals who dispute the very existence of economic rights. Then also by some human rights NGOs who believe that the work on economic and social rights can need to be restricted to the area of discrimination and to the extent that there are arbitrary restrictions on it, because in that way we can use the traditional mechanisms of fighting for human rights. We can hold the state responsible. We can name and shame the very traditional tools. But beyond that, the tools are restricted. There have been some academics, like Professor David Kennedy, that have actually challenged the human rights movement in the sense that he has said that the human rights movement is structurally not competent to look at economic and social rights, because the human rights movement looks at abuse. It doesn't look at the causes of abuse. And you cannot look at economic rights without looking at issues of distributive justice, without looking at the causes, and therefore the human rights movement is not appropriate movement to be looking at these issues. There are still others, both within the human rights movement and outside, who argue that we do not have the skills or resources to work on economic and social rights. And it's interesting that no one, in the human rights movement at least, has ever challenged the fact that we should not be working on the right to a fair trial, because nothing is more expensive than a fair trial. Resources don't seem to be matter in that situation. Now, I would say that the denial of economic and social rights, as much as civil and political rights, is at the root of the most of the human suffering in the world today. And if we turn our back on that suffering, or say that a human rights response has no place in alleviating economic and social rights, then I think the human rights movement will have effectively marginalized itself and made itself irrelevant to the vast majority of the world's population. And we will be an elitist bunch working for the rights of the elite, those who cannot read the newspaper of their choice rather than those who cannot read, full stop. Also, I feel that if we fail to build our work on economic and social rights, we will also fail in our work on terrorism and human rights. Because I remember Kofi Annan's words here, and he said, "We now see with chilling clarity that a world where many millions of people endure brutal oppression and extreme misery will never be fully secure, even for its most privileged inhabitants." So there is a link between misery and violence, and that's what makes human rights so relevant in that area. But of course, we should not underestimate that the challenges that economic and social rights pose for the human rights movement. We will need to understand and redefine concepts like equality, not simply as an absence of discrimination, but more substantively, as Amartya Sen, for example, has talked about equalizing capabilities rather than equalizing the actual rights. We must review the notion of responsibility for economic and social rights in a different kind of way, because it does create transnational responsibilities when we're talking about issues of structural adjustment, aid flows, debt relief, and so on. So this is very, very different from the way in which the human rights movement has worked on civil and political rights, which has been highly individualized. Now, I think the third area I would say of challenges for the movement lies in the nature of the actors with whom we are working. The state, of course, remains the primary actor for human rights, but as I mentioned earlier, the state accountability systems are not working, and one needs to review that, particularly the multilateral system of human rights. And I think what's quite dangerous at the moment is the way in which the UN itself has come under attack. And we need to resist that attack, and yet we need to engage constructively in reform of the UN human rights system. One academic has talked about creating a human rights vision of the state. And what he meant by it was that we need to identify what only a state can do to deliver human rights and lobby for its fulfillment. And that's an interesting concept of looking at what the state can and cannot do in a world situation where the role of the state in many ways is changing, becoming restricted. We need also to look at the whole area of private actors and their accountability for human rights, either directly or through the state. And women's human rights here have shown the important role that private actors play both in promoting and in abusing human rights. In a globalized economy, of course, corporate and financial actors need to be brought into this framework of accountability. And there are initiatives underway in the UN, for example, looking at human rights norms for business. And this could provide an opportunity gradually to build up a framework of rights standards for companies. Globalization, of course, has also affected international financial institutions have to be brought into this notion of transnational responsibilities in terms of external debt, structural adjustment, international trade agreements. So again, this is a whole new area of accountability with which we as human rights movement need to engage. It's a challenge, but it is, of course, critical if we are to continue with our work. And as we engage with new actors, we need to examine the approaches that we have used. Naming and shaming is not particularly helpful in many of these new situations. Say, for example, when it comes to armed groups, I don't think the Al-Qaeda is going to be particularly impressed if Amnesty International launches a campaign of naming and shaming it, or even a letter-writing campaign, for that matter, if you knew where to send the letters. Of course, when it comes to economic and social rights, we have to engage in policy debates. We have to look at budget allocations. We need to look at a totally different skill sets. And, of course, looking at governments, too, there's an interesting phenomenon that we find happening now where many governments have actually bought into the argument of human rights. They don't challenge that anymore. The question they keep asking us, how do we do it? And this is very interesting if you look at countries like Turkey at the moment. On Turkey, Amnesty has been working for decades, protesting, exposing, campaigning for change, and finally the government is now ready for change, and it's actually asking us to engage rather than be on the outside criticizing. And that is, again, a new role for many civil society actors, where there is the fear that we get co-opted. On the other hand, if we stay out, then we miss the opportunity of influencing the process. And it's a question at the end of the day of using a range of approaches and tools, from human rights education to targeted lobbying to mass mobilization, sometimes working within the system and sometimes working from without. And to give you an example of the kind of challenges that are being posed, I want to mention the case of a young woman that I met in Kabul, in the women's prison there. Now, this prison was full of women who had been thrown in there for committing adultery, for wanting to marry the man of their choice, for running away from brutal husbands, and so on. So these were basically not crimes in the sense in which most of us would understand it. And in that prison, I met a 16-year-old girl called Jamila. She had been abducted from her home in Kunduz by a man who forcibly tried to marry her. She told me that she did not recognize the marriage. Her hands and feet had been tied during the ceremony. She was not married to him, but of course she was abused by him. She was raped by him. In the end, she was abused also by his uncle, and she ran away. And the police caught her, brought her back. She was beaten up again. She ran away again, and this time the police put her in prison because that was the safest place for her to be. She said to me that all she wanted to do was actually go home to her father, but she was afraid that he would kill her because she had destroyed his honor, and if he didn't kill her, certainly the man who had abducted her would. And in fact, just a few months before I met Jamila, President Karzai had given amnesty to 20 such women, and one of them had in fact been killed by her family, and a number of them had disappeared. So here it wasn't just a situation of saving Jamila, it was a challenge of changing a system. And that is something very different from the way in which a human rights organization like Amnesty has worked in the past, whereas, you know, our work has centered around individuals. Our work still centers very heavily around individuals. But releasing one prisoner is clearly not the answer when it comes to situations like Afghanistan. And that is, I think, a huge challenge for the human rights movement as such, for human rights organizations like Amnesty. And looking at these challenges, I have spoken now so far about external factors, but let me just say a few words about internal challenges that we face. And one challenge is within the human rights movement itself, about the kinds of alliances we need to make now within the movement and with other social movements. There has been, of course, huge growth, as I mentioned earlier, as you all know, in the NGO sector, in civil society organizations, women's groups, local groups, some who are global, some who are international, but not necessarily global. And in that sort of a context, there are tensions also developing. There are opportunities as well of cooperation between North and South, but also differences of views between the global and the local. How do we actually bring them together to the benefit of both? What is the role of a global international human rights organization when human rights abuses are so local? How do we promote the notion that human rights, Amnesty is based on a very simple philosophy, that human rights anywhere is the concern of people everywhere. Now, how do we promote that notion of international solidarity without actually implying a kind of neo-imperialistic advocacy of the North to situations in the South? And a lot of our work within Amnesty actually has focused on building partnerships and relationships with local NGOs, with local communities, and realizing that the future of human rights actually lies at that level with the community itself and seeking to support them. And in March last year, we launched our campaign to stop violence against women, and that campaign deliberately focuses on working not only with the women's movement, but working with local women's groups in their own countries, building a new constituency for human rights. Looking inwards again, I think this also brings, as we work with these constituencies, as we become part of a broader constituency of activists in civil society, the broader issue is of accountability and responsibility. Because with power comes responsibility. I've spoken about the power and responsibility of states. I've spoken about the power and responsibility of companies and financial actors. NGOs today are also very powerful actors. And along with power, we must be ready to expose ourselves, subject ourselves to the same scrutiny that we are demanding of others. Now, for an organization like Amnesty International, which, as you know, is a highly democratic internal system, there has always been a high level of internal accountability. And the challenge, of course, for us is external accountability. The challenge for many other NGOs might well be both internal and external accountability. And here, of course, questions arise as to what do we mean by accountability. There are some NGOs that will say, human rights groups that will say, that accountability depends on performance. We will be judged by our results. But the key question becomes for advocacy NGOs, what are the results? And how do you evaluate the results? To what extent has Amnesty International been responsible for the creation of the International Criminal Court? And if we claim responsibility for that, what responsibility do we claim for people being locked up in Guantanamo, on the other hand? It's an interesting question of impact assessment there. Then, of course, there is the other type of accountability, and that is the voice accountability. Voice accountability. To whom are we accountable? Are we accountable to the middle-class human rights elite? Traditionally, as you know, Amnesty International adopted prisoners of conscience, who tended very much to be middle-class people. Or do we want a broader constituency? And how do we become accountable to the broader constituency? How do we become accountable to women like Zainab, for example, whose case I put to you here now? And these are issues with which we are struggling to find answers, on which we are working. I don't think we have perfect systems yet. But these are the challenges that we need to think about. In Amnesty, for example, when we launched our campaign to stop violence against women, we actually accompanied it with an internal campaign looking at our own gender policies, because we felt that we could not ask others to do something when we ourselves were not willing to do that. But of course, this is an evolving area. Accountability is an evolving area, but it is an area where we will come under increasing pressure as human rights activists, as NGOs, as members of civil society. And let me just end by saying, at the end of the day, of course, the human rights movement is about people. People who care, people who are ready to be passionate, who are ready to be angry, who are ready to be optimist. To many governments, we are troublemakers. Some of them label us as subversives. And in a sense, yes, we are subversives, because we are fighting established power. We are fighting to change We constantly challenge power, and we have a vision of a world in which the powerful and the powerless have equal rights. And in that sense, we are also eternal optimists. We are what I would call hope mongers. We trade in the business of hope in a hopeless world. But I'm convinced that our optimism and our creativity at the end of the day will prevail, and that the human rights movement will be able to redefine itself in the face of challenge. I know it sounds like an enormous degree of optimism, but I think in our business, that's what our business is all about. And I'll just end by telling you what a man that I met in Jerusalem, in Israel, told me. The Israeli man whose 16-year-old daughter had been killed by a suicide bomber. And he said to me, "I could have made my grief a tool of revenge, but I decided to make it a platform for change." And he is the founding member of the Forum for Bereaved Families who are working for peace in the Middle East. That's the kind of choices that I think human rights activists have to make from time to time. It's a big challenge, but I do hope that we will be able to meet the challenge. So thank you.
Indeed, for an extremely stimulating presentation, and it was very interesting to hear about some of the new directions of Amnesty International and other human rights organisations and some of the challenges that you are facing now. I'm going to open this up to questions and answers. I want to avoid people leaving during the questions and answers, so if you are going to leave, can you leave now? Rather than in and out all the time. Thank you. I should also say that we are encountering a few problems with the mics. So when we come to the questions and answers, please could you speak loudly? Okay. Let's start off then. Yes, gentleman at the back. And if you could speak loudly and say your name and affiliation and then pose your question. Thank you. Can you speak up?
Something that I find quite puzzling is just the link between human rights and the prevailing security perceptions of what, whether a group is feeling a sense of post 9/11, that sense of insecurity seems to have spread. In fact, it has spread throughout the world. And the way I understand human rights, there is a certain element of empathy, taking the origins of human rights with sort of groups that may not have the same privileges or opportunities as those. And my question then is, when this sort of sense of security has spread globally, the extent to which we see it emerging, when does the tide turn? Do we sort of gradually wait for this sense of insecurity to pass? Do we actively sort of challenge the insecurity? And I think there are certain arguments to be made for the sense of insecurity heightened by governments and certain organizations in society, but the events weren't themselves constructed with their own powers that were the things that
Okay, thank you. And can you tell us where you are from? Okay, a freelance writer, and the question was about the spread of insecurity and when should we begin to act. Thank you.
That's a very broad, good nice broad question. Well, I think, of course, we constantly live with one form of insecurity or one form of threat or other. I mean, in our private lives, in our public lives, as nation states, as individuals. That's always there in any society. The question really is, how do you react to, how do you respond to threats or perceived threats? And there, this is where we have seen the response post 9/11 has been a response that has been driven. It's a security strategy, but behind the security strategy is the notion that by restricting the human rights of some, you create greater security for others. But the test of that is to see, well, what actually happens by locking up people in Guantanamo or by arresting people and detaining them or torturing them, by invading Iraq, have you created a safer world? Do we as individuals feel safer today because of what has happened? And I think there are different views. As a human rights activist, I would say no. The world is not safer today. We are not anymore, you know, safe today than we were on the 10th of September 2001. In some ways, at least some experts are saying that there is a greater threat today of terrorism than there was in the past, even because of what has happened in Iraq. So I think it's the response that we look at. Now, on the positive side, what we also see is that people tend to feel more secure when they feel that their rights, their assets are better protected. And so human rights, respect for human rights can actually create a stronger sense of security. So it's quite the reverse of the security strategy which the US administration has been pushing out in recent years. And it's really, if you look at stable societies, if you look at secure societies, those are ones which are based in the rule of law where people feel protected. So I think there has constantly been this debate about human rights and security. But the real issue is, whose security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of the nation state, or are we talking about the security of people? And when do people feel secure? People feel secure when their rights are protected, when they have a job, they have shelter, they have access to certain basic services. So, you know, it's the whole question of whose security are we looking at, and what kind of a security strategy will be more sustainable in creating a more stable world at the end of the day. And I think it's a very good question to ask on the eve of the inauguration of a second Bush administration.
Can you say who you are and keep your question short, as we don't have microphones?
My name is Anna. I'm from the LSE staff. And my question is, especially on the eve of the inauguration of the second Bush administration, how does a human rights organization like Amnesty International react to the profound disillusionment on human rights that have occurred past the mass demonstrations against the Iraq war, happening anyway, and past the pictures of Guantanamo Bay becoming open to the public to see, and yet no profound change of reaction? How does Amnesty International react to this situation?
Could everyone hear the question?
I think it's a very good question. And this is the question that I was saying about how the whole debate about values seem to have slipped us by as human rights movement. And I think our failure, if I can put it that way, has been our inability to actually capture the hearts and minds of people on such a big issue. And I think there are lessons to be drawn here, and for us to re-examine where we have gone wrong. Now, Amnesty International historically has been seen as the organization that stands by victims. That's what we have done, you know, prisoners of conscience, political prisoners, death penalty, people subjected to death penalty, and so on. And yet, in this human rights security debate, we have been accused of siding, talking more about the rights of the perpetrators than the rights of the victims of terrorist attacks. And I think human rights becomes a complex issue, very difficult to get across to the masses, is this whole issue of a society where if you are not prepared to protect the rights of the guilty, you cannot protect the rights of the innocent. And making that a value issue of what kind of a society do we want to live in, where are we going down this path? At the moment, it's only the marginalized who are being affected. And that's probably why there is this total sort of apathy, if I can put it that way. Who's actually picked up in the U.S.? You know, it's the Muslims, the minorities, Arabs, etc., a few thousand. It's not the vast majority of Americans who are being affected by it. For most of us, it's a question of an extra check at the airport or something like that. So the real cost of the war on terror is not being felt by us yet. But what we do see is the widening divide between people. There's a polarization that is taking place. When I go, I'm just coming back from my own country, which is Bangladesh, and there we see what is happening is that there has been a reaction. There is a fundamentalist wave now coming. And what it is doing is that it's squeezing the liberal space. It's squeezing the space where tolerance and diversity actually exist. And people are either with us or against us. They're either good or evil. And it depends, you know, on who you are as to how you define good and evil. And that type of deep-seated hatred and polarization, I think, is going to affect all of us. And it is beginning to affect us. And I think it needs to be much more than a human rights debate. I think it needs to be a values debate. It needs to be a debate about the kind of society we want, the kind of people we are, and make it. Because if you talk about human rights, it's somehow easily translated into legal issues, into legal protection, and we lose the attention of people. But if we start talking about people, about humanity, about simple concepts of justice, is it just to lock people up for years without even knowing who they are and what they've been locked up for? I think people might think a little bit more differently.
Okay, yes.
Hi, my name's Shivali. I'm just wondering, I'm doing a piece of politics coursework at the moment, and I'm looking at child labour in India and the human rights violations of the country. Are Amnesty doing anything involved with child labour in India? And if you're not, how would you think that if you could do anything, what kind of things could you do to reduce it?
Well, actually, the answer is simple. No, we are not working on child labour in India.
Okay. The person at the back up there. Can you speak up and say your affiliation?
Yeah, I'm Dalala, and I'm from India. I'd just like to ask that you just mentioned about Turkey going to India on human rights issues and all. Developing countries or nations are willing to engage on issues like human rights and these kind of issues. But what is the strategy that Amnesty would adopt, or you would request it should be adopted for developed nations or powerful nations to engage in the dialogue about human rights, where they are basically at the forefront of violating human rights issues and all. And UN has so far not been able to play a very effective role. What is it that you would suggest?
Well, I think where developed countries, or for that matter, developing countries as well, are concerned, I think the best pressure comes from within. And this is why, for Amnesty International, we are a membership-based organization, and we seek to influence people, you know, in their own societies to take up these issues as their issues. And in the US, for example, Amnesty has 300,000 members, Amnesty International members of Amnesty USA. In the UK, I think we have at the moment, we have slightly more members than the Labour Party. and we would like to mobilize them within their own political systems, to put pressure on their own governments to bring about change, to protest. So to protest and to protect. And I think that's the strategy by which Amnesty works. Amnesty's strategy is that ordinary people can actually bring about extraordinary change through very simple things like letter writing, for example, intervening with your member of parliament, and so on. But the basic trigger is that something has happened, and I think this is a failure of the human rights movement, which I would admit openly. I think something has happened where we have failed actually to make human rights relevant to people who are comfortably placed. You know, there's a sense that human rights is about the poor and hungry and powerless somewhere else. It's not about us. It doesn't really affect me. It doesn't really affect you. And so we either seek to engage on human rights issues in Sudan and get very active about it, or we don't talk about human rights in our own societies. And somehow, we need, as human rights activists, we need to make the language of human rights very relevant. We have found in Amnesty, for example, the campaign that's really galvanizing people and bringing a lot of people into Amnesty is our campaign to stop violence against women. Why? Because it's something that affects so many of us directly or indirectly. Most of us know at least one person who has been a victim of violence, a woman who's been a victim of violence, and suddenly we relate to it. So we've got to make these human rights stories real. I said that human rights is not just about text, it's about voice, it's about people. And if we can make the human rights stories stories of people, I think we will find that there will be greater empathy in developed countries as much as in developing countries. I think, you know, the real tactic of mobilizing people doesn't really matter whether you're developed or developing. It may matter in terms of the state, but not in terms of people themselves.
Gentlemen at the back.
Yes. Yes, can you give your affiliation and speak loudly, please?
I'm fine. I'm a human rights activist from Pakistan. And I'm a PhD student. We are facing now the sustainable dictatorship in Pakistan, you know. So when Bhumika is working in the state, Bita is working under the Kamba Parliament, the entire democratic system is working under the Kamba Parliament, and we are now facing the army of Iraq. So in this situation, how can we motivate the public, normal public, which is 150 million Muslim people in Pakistan? So and they are not very much happy with the reports of the Amnesty International, as you know, Asma Janambi, I'm one of the active members from the same province, the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. How can we work for the Muslim people when the army is not facing us? They are using every kind of tactics to reduce the voice of human rights in Pakistan.
Well, I think there are different strategies of activism. I mean, there are Amnesty staff members, for example, in this audience who spend, I think, their working day thinking about ways in which to activate, to find the levers of change in any society. And it will vary from society to society, whether you're talking about a democratic society or a dictatorship, whether you're talking about people who are engaged in human rights issues or a society where people are sort of apathetic. And in a situation like Pakistan, for example, you're right, where media is controlled, there's not much point in talking about the local media, and maybe one needs to, but yet we know that in today's information age, people access the websites, people access international media, maybe one needs to put out more. We also know that most countries, it's very hard to find a country, possibly Myanmar, but there are very few countries in the world that are immune to smears on their image. They're very image conscious, and therefore pressure, publicity, pressure on donors, pressure on allies can also have an impact on the way in which a particular government behaves. I mean, in the case of Pakistan, it has particular allies through whom it could be influenced. And there are particular allies that are probably sustaining the system of dictatorship, as you put it.
Thank you. I'm going to take a couple of questions together now from upstairs. The gentleman here and the gentleman in the second row there.
Yeah.
Can you make your questions short, not speeches? Thank you.
Bill Bick from City University. We all aware that the burden of human rights is only upon developing societies, and I think the problem will be unsolved. I mean, the Amnesty International will be powerless if they don't change the policy regarding human rights for developed countries. I'm going to take an example. In the Ivory Coast case, when the war started, Amnesty International sent people there for a report which came out, and after that report, it was seemed to be a one-sided report, which the government raised the when the government raised the issue, they had to go back again and try another report. The UN did the same thing, and they raised the issue. Recently, when the legal government started to bombard military sites of rebels. Another report came out and said that it's a human right. It's also against human rights. And you didn't do anything when the French president gave mandate to his militaries to bombard back the government, the legal government's military aircraft. You didn't do anything. And
okay,
even
thank
worse,
you.
They went and killed civilians who were protecting the legal government, and you didn't do anything at all. Whereas there were everywhere on the internet pictures showing those criminal activities mandated by the French government.
Okay, thank you very much. And the gentleman over here. Yeah. And again, can you keep your question short, please, so I can maximise audience participation?
Jonathan from OSU. 2 months ago, we heard from members of the panel of eminent persons on the role of civil society in the United Nations. And despite some of the problems that they recognise in the implementation of their recommendations, they seem to be quite happy with the fruits of their labours. What do you see? How do you see those things, and do you think that the UN is in fact the right way to go for civil society? What other options were there?
Okay, take one more down here, and then.
I just have sort of one short comment related to the devotion that you talk about. It's just an idea that I've been thinking about for 3 months now. That is the response. The Madrid bombing in Spain and how the Spanish people reacted to that, and not just in terms of as voters, but as people and as members of civil society in Spain, how they reacted. But I'm also thinking now to comparative civil society under Berlusconi in Italy and also in the Netherlands, with the unfortunate events that happened in the past few months in the Netherlands, which has created a lot of tension. That was just sort of a small comment. But my question is, and it's a difficult question, I'm a PhD student who's looking at human rights in Roma, and it's a question of what I unfortunately see as hierarchization of human beings within also, I would say, people of conscience. And this is a problem, and I'll just illustrate very briefly. Whenever I talk about Roma rights issues, I talk about what happened to African Americans also. 20, 30 years ago, and how I see the struggle that Roma face, very much akin to that of African Americans. And they say, well, we know about Martin Luther King, we know about so-and-so, you know, but what about Roma? What are they doing? How are they organizing? You know, are they not, you know? And there's this kind of almost implicit degradation or dehumanization, I find, about towards Roma. And I'm just illustrating that as an example. I'm sure there's many other groups that this has happened to, does happen. And I just wondered, how do you respond to that?
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
On the issue of UN and civil society, I think the report was actually initiated because there was a sense that civil society plays an increasingly important role on the international arena, and the UN has to find some way of dealing with that. The world conferences, for example, were a very good example of how civil society contributed to raising public awareness, to putting issues on the agenda, whether it was environment, women, human rights. And therefore, the role that civil society groups play in the UN is an extremely important one, although it is one without any formal legitimacy, in the sense that member states are members of the UN, not NGOs. And yet, informally, they have become absolutely essential actors, particularly when you look at an institution like the UN Human Rights Commission. It simply could not function. It would not have any legitimacy if there were not these human rights groups coming. And increasingly, what we see are not the large and powerful NGOs like Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch coming there. In fact, we see them coming less and less. And what we see are small groups coming from different countries, networking, working together. And it's a very interesting, energizing situation. For example, at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, there was a very, very active NGO group very controversial. There were huge debates about issues of slavery, compensation, about Palestine, about Zionism, and so on. But at the same time, it was a very lively debate. So I think what the UN has a very important role to play in building active dynamics in the society, because they in turn sustain democratic societies, create stability, open the space for expressing views in a peaceful manner, in continuing this debate, this evolution, I would say, of human progress and potential. On the Ivory Coast, I don't recall being silent on the issue of French intervention. As far as I recall, there were public statements made there. Maybe you may not agree with our statements, but I don't think we were silent on human rights abuses then. In the context of Madrid bombing, I think it is a very important point about how people reacted. And what is also interesting is the means through which people reacted and how the information society came on its own, because a lot of it was, in fact, through the GSM texting and so on, that people were able to be mobilized. And in a sense, when you look at the anti-globalization movements, when you look at the mass sort of mobilization that's taking place today, a lot of it is being fed in a very positive way through these information networks. So we are kind of increasingly living in a network society, moving away from institutions and individuals to networking and solidarity. How do we deal with reactions to marginalized communities, whether it's the Roma, whether it's the Dalits in India or others? I think it is a big issue, because I think the whole concept of identity is becoming increasingly a very important issue. I think in the context of Europe, I would say the biggest, probably the two major problems, human rights problems in Western Europe, would be migration and racism. And I think the Roma situation kind of falls into both those categories, because as Europe opens its internal borders, closes its external borders, as Europe kind of learns to live with its own multiculturalism and diversity, these issues are increasingly going to come up, and they are going to pose tension. And in a sense, human rights are very interesting there, because they kind of provide these sort of universal values and standards, glues that bring us together in a society that is constantly fracturing. And in that sense, I think there are some very, very important principles about discrimination, about equality, about equal access, that are absolutely essential in looking at Roma communities' situation from the perspective of human rights. So I think human rights have a lot to offer in dealing with these types of groups.
Okay, let's take a few more questions. The gentleman here. The gentleman right at the back there, and the gentleman here.
My name is Jared, and I'm an OSC grad student. One of Amnesty International's most unique campaigns, I think, has been the ability to start organizations at university campuses in Europe and in the U.S. And I'm wondering what you think is the future of Amnesty International's ability to reach out to the youth and specifically incorporate human rights education into curriculum, specifically in the UK and the US.
Thank you. The gentleman at the back.
My name is Rafa Kalk. I was interested in what you talked about, human rights becoming a moral issue. And one of the things that we saw very interestingly in America was that civil liberties unions, etc., were all bundled together with people who, George Bush said, you know, didn't really believe in God, and didn't really have faith. And how do you have a plan of engaging with this so-called moral majority in the United States, which really has to be one of the most important constituencies that the U.S. today is a hyperpower? How do you engage with them and not be, you know, marginalized as, you know, not God-fearing?
Yes.
My name is Sanjay De Silva. My question is related to what people are saying, which I agree is converting ideas into action. And I think that very simple ideas, like you said, and if you could give some advice to a young person who's considering what to do next in their life, then whether you would advise a person to go on and do more studies, perhaps at the master's program, or would you advise them to keep it as simple as possible? Because really, how much more do we need to know about thou shalt not torture people, you know, and basic rights to all the world's citizens, would you direct that person somewhere else?
Great question. Thank you. Okay. Youth and human rights education. Actually, interestingly enough, this year, in August this year, Amnesty has its International Council meeting, which is a meeting of 500 delegates from each Amnesty national chapter from around the world. We'll meet in Mexico. We'll make big decisions about our overall strategy, direction, policy, and so on. And two of the issues there are youth and human rights education, because we really do see our whole youth strategy as building a new generation of human rights activists and defenders, new leaders, leaders of the future, sometimes leaders of the present, because young people are very active in Amnesty. And both for youth and human rights education, we are also looking at new means of communication, of using new media, for example, new technology, using the internet much more than we did in the past to reach out to these audiences. So I think there are huge opportunities opening up here for global membership, for international membership, for electronic activism. Many of our Amnesty National chapters are actively engaged in electronic activism, using music, for example, to attract music and art, to attract a different constituency, a younger constituency. So yes, that is something very high on our priority, and we hope that many more of you will join us. Now, on the moral majority, I think you've made a very interesting point, because I would say that human rights is a kind of secular religion. And some of us are as fundamentalist in our approach as anyone belonging to one of the faiths. And there is a real risk there, because I think we need to reach out to as many people, because if we really believe that these are global values, that these are values rooted in almost every civilization, every culture, every religion. Interestingly enough, because Amnesty is a membership-based organization, we have in the US, for example, we have church groups, community groups that are linked with Amnesty's work. In the UK, for example, many of the Justice and Peace movement members are actually Amnesty members. So in a sense, religion should not exclude people from joining the human rights movement, although there has been, I would say particularly the international human rights movement, has tended to put itself outside in a very conscious way, in an effort to be impartial, has put itself outside religion, outside any political ideology, outside any economic support for any economic system. But it's very difficult in reality, because people are linked to religion. People have support for one political system or the other. People, as we work on economic and social rights, we cannot simply say that we have no opinion on any economic system. And this is a real challenge for international human rights organizations. To what extent are we going to engage into these value-based systems? And to what extent are we going to stay out of them? And if we do engage with them, then how do we retain our impartiality and our neutrality from the perspective of human rights? These are critical challenges, because I think in the past, particularly because of the Cold War situation, I know that Amnesty in particular stayed out of either promoting or supporting opposing any particular type of political system. But at the same time, we do know that the human rights situation will improve or deteriorate in depending on certain political or economic systems. So this is a debate that's going to engage the human rights activists more and more. Can we actually sit outside, sit on the fence, not be involved, and yet be effective in our work? The last one about ideas into action, whether you should do a master's or not. Well, I would probably say the best thing is join Amnesty. I think it's education is always valuable, and education is not necessarily always in the classroom. We always, it may seem strange to you, but one never stops actually learning, whether one is in a master's course or not. And I think that's the most important thing, that we remain open. I was listening to Hans Blix the other night talking, and he said something that struck me very much. He said how much better it is to search for the truth rather than to know the truth. And he was, of course, talking about a specific piece of truth.
Thank you very much.
very much. We'll take one last round of questions. The person just there. So please. And again, please refrain from making speeches if you intended to do that. Thank you.
It might seem the human rights in globally is only a matter for the civil society, and you mentioned Turkey's new approach to human rights as a possible outcome of your activities. But how do EU aspirations of the Turkish government come into play here? And just that question.
Okay, two down here. Yes.
My name is Leo, and I work for sexual reproductive rights NGO. And my question is on you say the importance of moving the human rights agenda and including economic and social rights. But I'd like to ask if, as the efficacy of Amnesty as an advocacy organization, if there isn't a danger of mission creep, and Amnesty trying to address all social, economic, cultural, and every kind of right possible in the world, and therefore losing, you know, the ability to actually address one issue at a time.
Yeah.
My name is Anne Seppo. I'm the research student from Germany, and my question is about the cooperation of Amnesty International with the ICC in The Hague. How strong and effective is the pressure that the does on the ICC, and how effective is the creation of the work on creation of new tribunals like the ICC?
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Let me start with the question about the ICC and the international tribunals. I think with the creation of the ICC, there is a general trend not to create more institutions, and rather to use this sort of standing permanent international criminal court that has been created. But I think the policies and the strategy of the US government vis-a-vis the ICC is going to play a very important part. Particularly given that there is now a second Bush administration. And I think Sudan will be an interesting case study. It would be, you know, we will know very shortly what the results of this International Commission of Inquiry are going to be, and whether, if the Commission, for instance, finds that there is genocide being committed in Darfur, then what is the international community going to do? One possibility would be, under the Rome Statute, for the UN Security Council to refer Darfur to the International Criminal Court. But the US would either have to, at least to abstain in that case in the UN Security Council, and by abstaining show some kind of a support for this institution. The other alternative would be to create a special tribunal or something for Sudan at some point. But again, that's kind of adding to institutions. The ICTY and the ICTR were, in one sense, they were effective in the sense that they did establish some very important principles. For example, rape as a war crime or a crime against humanity, and that later on fed into the Rome Statute. But at the same time, they were very expensive. But then I was listening once to Navi Pillay, who's now a judge at the ICC and who was a judge at the International Tribunal on Rwanda, and she said, well, justice is expensive. I mean, we know that even in the national criminal justice system. What we need to recognize always is that any of these tribunals, whether the ICC or any other tribunal, will only be able to try a handful of cases. So they are more sort of exemplary cases. What the ICC does, the Rome Statute does, is in parallel with creating the International Criminal Court, it puts an obligation on national systems. Any government that signs and becomes a party to the Rome Statute has to introduce laws about universal jurisdiction, has to put its own national system into order in order to be able to try war crimes and crimes against humanity wherever they might have been committed. So I think this is where the ICC is interesting, because it's actually trying to create a global system of international justice, not just focused on one institution, and therefore, in the long term, is likely to be more effective about dealing with the worst types of crimes. Mission creep for Amnesty. Yes, that is a big concern, actually, among Amnesty members, and many of them questioned Amnesty when Amnesty was looking at expanding its work. But in any organization, your resources are limited, and you have to make priorities. Even when Amnesty was working on a limited set of rights, we constantly had to choose within those rights what work we would do. So expanding our mission doesn't mean that we work on everything, because obviously we will have to make choices. And in fact, Amnesty's new mission has been accompanied by a rigorous attempt within the organization to set some strategic priorities and a planning system and an operational system and all sorts of mundane bureaucratic managerial systems, which some of my colleagues will recognize, the main purpose of which is that with our limited resources, with a broad agenda of issues, we still are able to invest in those places where we are likely to have the most impact. So that task is there regardless of whether our mandate is big or our mandate is small. But by broadening it, we are actually able to make those strategic choices or those choices in a much more strategic manner and look and try to really work towards impact. We are also putting into place impact assessment evaluation systems, which would be interesting in a few years' time to look back and see whether this has worked. Because we think our members are going to ask for it, our donors are going to ask for it, but I think generally people around will be asking, you know, what does actually Amnesty do? You know, are we making a difference? Then Turkey and what's happening there. I think it's interesting what's happening in Turkey. I think the whole issue about its membership in the European Union has actually been a very important catalyst in pushing the Turkish government towards opening itself to human rights change. And of course, organizations like Amnesty, which have worked in Turkey for a very long time, have exploited that window of opportunity, and we've tried to put pressure, we've tried to come up with constructive ideas to work with the Turkish human rights defenders to really see change. There have been improvements, but there's still a very long way for Turkey to go. So I think it's a kind of situation strategy on Turkey is to encourage and recognize changes that have been made, but also at the same time to keep up pressure for more change. Particularly, what we see in Turkey is interesting, where the laws are being changed, because that's the easiest part. The harder part is actually implementing them and actually getting the systems, the bureaucratic systems, the justice systems, the police systems, and so on to change. I think the last one was about the language, changing the language. It's interesting about language. You know, the term human rights have, in a sense, they've become very popular, known to people. But Amnesty UK did a survey a couple of years ago where they actually asked people on the streets about human rights and most people and about Amnesty. And most people actually related most. They recognized Amnesty International, they recognized the logo, and then the next word they recognized was justice. So in a sense, one needs to make the language of human rights a more accessible language for people to relate to in terms of the values that we have in our everyday lives. And that's humanity, that's justice, that's equality.
Well, thank you very much indeed for a very stimulating and energizing presentation. If anyone came here as a doom monger, I hope they are now a hope monger. And maybe if they're making a choice between an MSc and joining Amnesty, do both. Reminded us about humanity and justice, please can I draw your attention to the tsunami appeal outside, and please encourage you to give generously to this appeal. Thank you very much indeed, and we look forward to seeing our guests upstairs. Thank you.